today we will calculate how the expansion of space-time can literally rip the vacuum apart and create particles in the process. We've seen before how field excitations can be created by a driving through an external force. We first did this for the plane harmonic oscillator that's driven by some classical external force. And we saw that there are Bogoliubov coefficients and that we can get excitation. And we found that we get coherent or squeezed states as the output of driving a harmonic oscillator that started in its ground state. Then we applied this to fields such as the electromagnetic field that are driven by charges and currents. These charges and currents act as external driving forces on the harmonic oscillators of the modes of the field. And again, we saw Bogoliubov coefficients and the possibility to excite the field through the external driving. This is how an antenna operates, after all. Now, we will study the parametric driving of the harmonic oscillators of a field. So now we will study what happens if you have a quantum field, such as a Klein-Gordon field, that lives on a space-time that is dynamic. In particular, FRW space-time, and in particular, it might be expanding in a dramatic way. Then, what can happen is that just because the space-time is expanding, this will change the parameters of the mode oscillators in such a way, in a dynamical way, in a time-dependent way, that the mode oscillators, even if they started in their ground state, may end up in an excited state. And what we will see is that gravity produces these particles out of nothing, just because of the expansion, not individually, but in pairs, as one might expect. Because if we do this with an FRW space-time, then we have translation invariance. Therefore, we should have spatial momentum conservation. And if we produce a particle with a momentum in one direction, we better also produce a particle with the opposite momentum in the other direction. And that's what we will find. Okay, so let's remember how far we got. We are solving the quantized Klein-Gordon equation on FRW space-times. And the strategy we pursue is this. We know that we obtain a solution to the quantum field through this ansatz here, because that will lead to the fulfillment of the hermeticity condition, the equation of motion, and the canonical commutation relations. If the following conditions are met, first of all, we need the A and A dagger to be chosen such that they have these commutation relations, which is, we know how to do this, and we know how to build a Fock basis of a Hilbert space out of these operators. And this is a solution if we find classical functions uk of x and t that go here and there, which have the property that they have to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, to the classical Klein-Gordon equation. Classical because these are number valued, complex number valued. And that's the tricky part, these so-called mode functions also have to obey this so-called Wronskian condition, which is literally the condition that these guys have to obey such that the phi and the pi obey the canonical commutation relations. And we notice that because there's a Dirac delta on the right-hand side, we can never fulfill this as long as we have here only a finite number of mode functions, because they are regular functions, and that's a distribution, so we need an infinite number of them. Right. And then, once we've done all this, once we have found these mode functions, or such mode functions, then we can use the AK and AK dagger to build a convenient basis in the Hilbert space on which the field acts. Namely, we consider the vector 0 that we should not call the vacuum. It may or may not be the vacuum. It depends on which mode functions we choose. So we choose this vector, we consider this vector zero, which is the vector that's annihilated by all of the AK operators. And of course, we normalize it as well. And then we consider all the other basis vectors that we obtain by applying arbitrary powers of the AK dagger operators on this vector zero here. If we apply the AK dagger more than once, then we have to multiply with a normalization factor to make sure that the entire vector, basis vector, is still normalized. Okay, so we know how to solve the problem. But it's not unique. As we saw before, there is not just one set of mode functions that are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation and obey the Wronskian condition. No, there are infinitely many of those. And it's completely up to us which choice we make. No matter what the problem is we want to solve, we can always work with any choice we want. Some choices, though, will be much more convenient than others. And often, it will be convenient to make one choice at one time and another choice at another time. For example, we may make one choice at one time when things are still simple. You could imagine a Minkowski space. We know what mode functions to choose for Minkowski space. And then all hell breaks loose. Minkowski space is no longer Minkowski space suddenly. It starts expanding for some reason, and it undergoes a period of very strong accelerated expansion, for example. And then it slows down again and becomes Minkowski space again. Well, clearly, while it's difficult to do the intermediate thing, at the beginning, it's Minkowski space. At the end, it's Minkowski space. So there is a preferred choice of mode functions in either case. And the preferred choice is, of course, then that choice of mode function such that the vector zero happens to be the vacuum state. But in principle, we don't have to. We can make any choice anytime we want. It's just a matter of convenience. So now, choosing a different set of classical solutions, a different set of mode functions, which obey the Wronskian condition, still gives us the same field, right? Remember, whether we write the field in terms of mode functions U and the operators A and their complex conjugate or Hermitian conjugate, we can also express the same field in terms of other mode functions and other operators. But then, of course, these mode functions must be expressible in terms of the other mode functions, and these A tilde operators must be expressible in terms of the untilded A and A dagger operator. That this is always so, that we can always express the tilded quantities in terms of the untilded ones, is guaranteed by the Stone and von Neumann theorem, which says that any such representation can only differ by a change of basis. So we are guaranteed that this is always possible. So now we apply this to Friedmann-Robertson-Walker-Lemaître spacetimes. And the first thing we noticed there was that the equation of motion for the Klein-Gordon field phi contained a term with the first derivative in the time, which is typically what occurs in the case of friction. And friction is dissipative. We'd like to work with harmonic oscillators that are not dissipative. It's easier to work with them. And so as a convenient measure, we introduce the field chi, which is simply a rescaled version of the field phi. That had the advantage that once we work with the field chi, we obtain a Klein-Gordon equation that contains only the second time derivative. Remember, this is conformal time because it's a prime. The proper time derivatives have dots. It contains only the second time derivatives and no time derivative of chi. So the friction term is now absent. We just have to keep in mind that once we are done calculating everything for chi hat, we should transform back into the field phi variable, which is trivial. We just take the chi and divide it by A, and we get everything in terms of phi that differ just by a function, which is the scale factor. All right, so what we arrived at is the following problem. in FRW spacetimes, this prescaled field chi, which we should expect in the far future to have tremendously large amplitudes, because it's the old field phi multiplied with the scale factor, which increases as the universe expands, right? So the chi has artificially large amplitudes. But we get rid of that when we go back into the variable phi, when we transform back to the variable phi. So what we arrived at is that this variable chi obeys a Klein-Gordon equation that already looks very much like a harmonic oscillator. Second derivative of chi is equal to something, something, and then chi. So it looks as if this was a backdriving force. But it's not quite that. Almost, right? It's similar. We are arriving here at the point that we arrived at also in the case of Minkowski space with the Klein-Gordon equation. Namely, let us drop that term for a moment. Then what do we have? Then we have second time derivative of chi at the location x is equal to, if you put all of this to the other side, equal to this bracket with a minus sign times chi of x. And this means that at every location x, there's a degree of freedom which is a harmonic oscillator. Right? If I choose an x, then we have this degree of freedom chi at x. It has a time dependence, eta. And the second time derivative of it is equal to minus this times this, the amplitude. Which means this is the coefficient of the backdriving force. This tells us how strong the backdriving force is of the harmonic oscillator. Of course, we notice here that this backdriving force is time dependent. There's lots of etas in here, but we were sort of mentally prepared for this because now everything is happening on an expanding space-time. Whereas in Minkowski space, there would be no time dependence. In Minkowski space, it's the same equation, except there's only the m squared term here. The a is constantly 1, and there is no time derivative of the scale factor, so that term is gone. So in Minkowski space, we have that indeed, at every point in space, we have a harmonic oscillator, where the backdriving force is given is proportional to m squared. Now we have a time-dependent backdriving force, which is what generates the parametric driving. Remember that the harmonic oscillator can be excited in two ways, externally driven, or also by changing its parameters in a time-dependent way, for example, the backdriving force. However, there is this term here, and that term mixes x with its neighbors because it contains derivatives. If we discretize space, then this becomes a finite difference operator that takes differences between the chi at neighboring points, and therefore the harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. Well, they better be, because otherwise, if you excite the field here, the excitation would not spread. But we expect quantum fields, just like classical fields, to spread information. Just like when you throw a stone into a pond, then you're not just exciting the oscillators where the stone hits the water. No, these oscillators excite the oscillators nearby, and they excite the oscillators nearby. That is mathematically represented by this Laplacian term. So we ought to have this. But mathematically, we would find it much more convenient if we had independent harmonic oscillators, not coupled ones, because then we could solve the equation of motion for each harmonic oscillator separately. We can do this the same way that we did it in Minkowski space. We simply Fourier transform in space. As we Fourier transform in space, these second derivatives simply become k squares. So our observation is that the derivatives d by dxi that arise in the Laplacian become multiplication operators I, k, under spatial Fourier transform. So let us do this. This will be really convenient. So we take our chi field that in principle depends on position and time, conformal time, and we simply Fourier transform it in space. Then we obtain chi hat of k. And just like we did in Minkowski space, the Fourier transform variable to x, which legally ought to be after the eta with a comma, right? There should be eta comma k. But there is a tradition in the field that the k is written as an index. And then that transformation is invertible. We can, of course, also express chi of x in terms of the chi of k. If we do everything in a box, then we have only a discrete set of k values. This integral goes only over a box. We have an infrared regularization. The k values become discrete, and then this integral becomes a sum. And we do the same Fourier transform for the canonically conjugate field for pi k, the canonically conjugate to chi. Again, just the usual Fourier transform here. After the Fourier transform, we obtain that the Fourier transformed chi field obeys this Klein-Gordon equation. The only thing that happened really is that instead of having eta comma x, we have eta and k, and that the Laplacian turned into k squared. It used to be minus Laplacian, and now it's plus k squared. If we want to see that this is very much a harmonic oscillator or a bunch of harmonic oscillators, all we need to do is write this on the right hand side, and then we obtain that the second time derivative for each degree of freedom at k, so if we hold k fixed, then we have the second time derivative is equal to minus this bracket times the amplitude. So this is the backdriving force for our harmonic oscillator. So overall, the picture now is this. In momentum space, in K space that is, in K space we obtain independent harmonic oscillators because only one K arises in this. So for every K we can solve this, it's just a harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent backdriving force. And all of the magic of space-time being expanding is in the time dependence in here. Let us again check how this changed from Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, we would have this too, k squared from the Fourier transform of the Laplacian. We would have that the m squared a squared term is just n squared, because a is just 1, the scale factor is 1 and doesn't change in Minkowski space. And there wouldn't be a second time derivative of the scale factor, so that term would be absent. Any other change to Minkowski space that you can think of? There's one more change that's a little bit hidden, which is that the k doesn't mean what it used to mean in Minkowski space. And the reason is that the x, of which it is the Fourier transform, is not what it used to mean in Minkowski space. X in Minkowski space was just distances, was just ordinary coordinates. But in an expanding space-time, we found it useful to use a co-moving coordinate system, a coordinate system that shows 1 meter for 1 meter now, but that then grows with the expansion of the universe. And that means that the Fourier transform variable, the k, correspondingly mean wavelengths that keep changing over time. Right? So the same k means a small wavelength in the past and a large wavelength in the future. That's going to be very important. And also intuitively, we can see why the k, why we had to choose k that are the Fourier transforms of the co-moving coordinate system in order to obtain the decoupling of the harmonic oscillator. You see, the harmonic oscillators are decoupled in the sense that there's no derivative with respect to k in here. Imagine we had not done this. The universe is expanding, but we don't care. We choose a coordinate system that is proper distances, not only now, but always. So it's not a co-moving coordinate system, like a growing coordinate system, but it's a fixed coordinate, a fixed grid, right? And then we choose the Fourier transform of that, which we may call P or whatever. Later on in the course, we will look at this variable and call it P. If we had done that, the Klein-Gordon equation would contain derivatives with respect to P after the Fourier transform. Why is that? Remember when I said that if you throw a stone into the water, you're exciting the local harmonic oscillator, but it is coupled to the neighbors. And that's how the wave spreads. The harmonic oscillator is handing down the oscillations, the excitation to the neighboring harmonic oscillators. Now, in this case, we're not throwing any stones anywhere, but the universe is expanding. So imagine, for example, you excite the field by creating a laser beam. So there's a laser beam traveling there with a fixed wavelength. Then, as the universe expands, these laser waves are going to have larger and larger wavelengths, which means that the harmonic oscillators will hand the oscillations to each other, right? If you create an electromagnetic wave with wavelengths 100 nanometers, then sometime later, the harmonic oscillator of 100 nanometers will be de-excited, and the harmonic oscillator with 101 nanometers will be excited, right? So the process of the mode oscillators of proper distances, proper wavelengths, exciting each other so that you have a wavelength growing, right? So the growth of a wavelength as the universe expands under the wave, that growth is comparable to throwing a stone in the water. There too, harmonic oscillators excite each other. But in an expanding space-time, it's that we have one harmonic oscillator at every momentum, and they hand their excitations to each other, right? So large momentum harmonic oscillators have short wavelengths. They get de-excited. If they are excited, they get de-excited and hand their excitation to the next harmonic oscillator of slightly longer wavelength. And then that one gets de-excited, hands its excitation to the harmonic oscillator to the next larger wavelength. And that would show up in the Klein-Gordon equation having d by dp derivatives in them. And that means that we have a partial differential equation instead of a bunch of ordinary differential equations, harder to solve. So it's much more convenient to work with the co-moving coordinate system and its co-moving momenta, because the co-moving momentum means different wavelengths at different times, but in such a way that it grows with the universe. So if you create an electromagnetic wave at a particular wavelength and you have its co-moving harmonic oscillator excited, well, yeah, the wavelength grows, but the co-moving harmonic oscillator is still the same one. It still describes the same wave. So we have decoupled the harmonic oscillators by making the coordinate system grow with the space-time. Lots of intuition, but the math is really quite simple. All right, so we have reduced the problem of solving the Klein-Gordon field, quantum field theory on an expanding FRW spacetime to the problem of solving all of these harmonic oscillators. And once we've solved them, then we have to transform what we find for the chi back to the phi field by dividing it by A. So what does it amount to solve the quantum theory of these chi modes? Well, we have here that this is the equation for every fixed k, for every point in momentum space, we have a harmonic oscillator with frequency omega index k squared. And the omega index k squared is this. So here, omega k is the square root of that. Right? Because that's the back driving force, it's also the frequency squared. Right. Now let's look at this equation here. What do we see? We see that the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is given by k squared plus m squared minus this term. So the frequency of the harmonic oscillator goes up as k squared goes up. Now what is k squared? K squared is the momentum, the moving momentum. And just like for the proper momentum, also the co-moving momentum, the larger the momentum, the shorter the wavelength. So the shorter the wavelength, the faster the frequency of the oscillation, we would have guessed that, right? So that's something that's still left over from, it's just the same behavior as in Minkowski space. The mass term also affects how quickly a mode is oscillating, how quickly a wave is oscillating. Remember that K describes how quickly a wave is oscillating in space. Omega describes how quickly it is oscillating in time. This relationship is called a dispersion relation, right? It relates momentum to energy, or spatial oscillation frequency to temporal oscillation frequency. And of course, the mass impacts the energy, and therefore the temporal oscillation frequency, so that term is here as well. And then we have this new term here that is only existing if the universe is expanding in an accelerated way. If we have here an A double prime, that's non-zero. And what we also see is that this term has the opposite sign of those guys. If this was absent, omega is always a real frequency. But what if this is dominating over those two terms? Then suddenly our omega is imaginary. We have an imaginary frequency. Something with an imaginary frequency is not oscillating. It is exponentially increasing or exponentially decreasing. And we will find both, but the exponentially decreasing part will not be important later on because it's decreasing so fast, but there will be an exponentially increasing part that will be super important. Now it might look from this that the exponentially increasing part means that there's going to be some sort of explosion in the field as it exponentially increase. And it will. Yes, it will. The fluctuations in the chi field will exponentially increase because of this, when this happens. But that doesn't mean that the physics goes crazy. Because remember, the chi field is not a physical field, it's phi. So we have to, in order to calculate the phi field, we have to divide the chi field by the scale factor, which grows exponentially. And so what we actually see then is that the fluctuations of the phi field actually will freeze. Instead of these two things that counteract each other, exponential increase because of imaginary frequency, but we have to, that's just the chi field that exponentially fast increases, but we have to divide it by the exponentially growing scale factor to get the phi field, and so the phi field will freeze. Now you might think, well, what's so exciting about the phi field freezing? Super important. Consider the electromagnetic field. How often have you seen it fluctuate in the vacuum? Not that often, right? If you look at the wavelengths that you see, you don't really see it fluctuate much. Or, on meter length scales or something, it doesn't really fluctuate much. But the smaller the wavelength is you look at, or let's say the smaller the space-time volume or spatial volume is you consider, the larger, the more pronounced the fluctuations of the field will be. It's a general feature in quantum fields that the smaller the region is in which you check for fluctuations, the more pronounced will they be. If you can only resolve large volumes of space, then the fluctuations still happen in there, but they average themselves out. Right? So if you look at it from far, you don't see the fine detail of these spiky fluctuations. But if you can zoom in and look at the fluctuations on the small volume scale, then you will see that there are large fluctuations. You will calculate that in all detail. So what that means is that in daily life, ordinarily, quantum fluctuations of a field usually don't matter for us. Because we live at large length scales where these fluctuations are averaged out. Don't really see them. But in electronics or just generally quantum optics experiments, you can actually see the quantum fluctuations of a field. Now the Klein-Gordon field, same deal as the electromagnetic field. Yes, it will have, as we will see and calculate, will have large fluctuations when you look at it with a fine microscope, fine resolution, and they will wash out at larger scales. But this phenomenon that we just talked about is going to be responsible for the fact that the Klein-Gordon field is capable of generating quantum fluctuations on cosmological sizes, intergalactic sizes. Why is that? It's because quantum fluctuations that were initially super small at a super small volume could freeze by the mechanism that we just discussed, this thing dominating over that. Then you have this exponential increase of the chi field because of the imaginary frequency, which is undone by the expansion factor of the universe, because you have to divide chi field by the exponential a in order to get the phi field. That freezing process makes it possible that as the universe expanded, the quantum fluctuations that are significantly large at tiny, tiny, tiny distances could freeze while the universe was expanding and still be large in amplitude when the corresponding fields have been stretched out to intergalactic scales. Okay, that was just a preview. I didn't even mean to say all of this, but couldn't help it. All right. Okay, so in extreme cases, what we can have is that this omega k can become imaginary because the a double prime is large enough, which is to say that the expansion rate is increasing fast enough. So we need acceleration for this, right? It's not the first, it's the second derivative. Another thing that we need to keep in mind here is that whether or not this term is imaginary, whether or not this frequency is imaginary, depends not only on this. It also depends on how large k is, or k squared is, which means that for small k squared, this change of frequency can happen more easily than for large k squared. Right? And we will have to find out what that means, because it will mean that while some modes have their fluctuations frozen, or the amplitude of their fluctuations frozen, others will not. And that has to do with when we are in the evolution here. Or maybe I give it away already when that happens. A mode, a particular wavelength given by a k, represents an increasing wavelength over time, because the k is co-moving momentum, right? So, you know, it's growing with the wavelength it means is growing over time. And when we have accelerated expansion in the universe, so we have that the a double prime is larger than zero, when you have accelerated expansion in the universe, then the universe has a horizon, a length beyond which you can't communicate anymore because light is not fast enough. Because more space is being created in a unit of time than light can cross in that unit of time. So if you have acceleration, then you have a horizon. It's a certain length beyond which you can't communicate. And any wavelength that is larger than that horizon size freezes. This is what happens, right? When they're larger than that, then they freeze. And so every mode will have that fate, can have that fate. You just have to wait until it has expanded to larger than the size of the horizon. So some modes may have crossed, at any given point in time, some modes may have already achieved a wavelength larger than the horizon, so they are frozen, and others still have wavelengths shorter than the horizon, and they're not frozen, they keep oscillating until the wavelength reaches the size of the horizon. All right. You don't need to remember all the details of what I just said. We will do this in detail later in the course. But we can already anticipate something like that has to happen. All right. Right. Okay, then I leave it to you as an exercise to show that the Hermitian conjugate of the chi field after Fourier transformation is given by the chi field at minus k. Remember, whenever you have a real valued function and you Fourier transform it, then it has this property that the Fourier transform at one frequency is the complex conjugate of that function at minus that frequency. And that's the same here. And the same is true for the canonically conjugate momentum. So the chi subscript k is not self-adjoint operator valued. It's not the same as its Hermitian conjugate, but that's just because of the Fourier transform. The canonical commutation relations between the chi and the pi after Fourier transform are these. Okay, it's simple to prove just by plugging things in. It's very similar to what we observed in Minkowski space. All right, now, let us try to solve the quantum field theory now in momentum space. Now, you may wonder, wait a moment, we already did all this in position space. Do we really have to do this over again in momentum space? What's the benefit? The benefit is that in position space, remember that the modes were coupled to each other. At every point in space x, we had a harmonic oscillator. But they were coupled to each other because of the Laplacian. And that meant that you need these infinitely many mode functions all to conspire and sum up to give you the Dirac delta, and it was a little bit of a mess. But in Minkowski space, in the Fourier transform space, after Fourier transform, we decoupled the harmonic oscillators, which means that the entire quantum field decomposes into just a bunch of independent, uncoupled harmonic oscillators. Therefore, for example, this Wronskian condition should become much easier, because we can fulfill this just for each harmonic oscillator on its own. We don't have a Dirac delta anymore, because we just have for one harmonic oscillator the simple canonical commutation relation. So things should be simpler. But we proceed the same way, just that we now do it in momentum space. Basically the same way, but things should come out simpler now because we can do it for every momentum k, for every co-moving momentum k separately. So here's our ansatz. chi k of eta, we try to represent in this way, namely as 1 over square root of 2, which is a convenient prefactor that will make formulas a little simpler later on. And then we have a mode function, which is now a function of k and eta instead of x and eta. Here again, minus k of eta. And then we have these operators ak and a dagger minus k. Now, if you wish, you can do as a little exercise. You can express these mode functions in terms of the mode functions in position space that we had before. The uk of eta and x is not very complicated. Basically, just careful bookkeeping while doing a Fourier transform. Okay, so now this ansatz here, equation A, actually solves the hermeticity condition trivially, because if we take the Hermitian conjugate of this, then we obtain that term becomes this, and this term becomes that, except that k goes into minus k when you do this. And that's what we need, because remember that after Fourier transform, if you take the Hermitian conjugate of that, it's the same as if you took k to minus k. So the hermeticity condition is now also obeyed in this way. Further, these mode functions are assumed to obey the Kangorden equation, of course, but now in momentum space. And if they do, then clearly the chi will, because the A doesn't have any time dependence in it. So if those have the right time dependence, then this one has the right time dependence. Kangorden equation is a linear equation. So therefore, if this is the solution, that's the solution. It's not only a linear equation, it has real coefficients. So therefore, if this is the solution, that is the solution. And so the sum of the two is the solution. Okay, so this ansatz will guarantee the hermeticity condition. It will guarantee that this obeys the Klein-Gordon equation if the V mode functions obey the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, what do we still have to fulfill in order to get the commutation relations too? So the equations of motion here, I wrote down the Klein-Gordon equation again for in momentum space. And the point is that we need the V mode functions to obey the Klein-Gordon equation in momentum space, right? So this harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent frequency that can go imaginary and so on. Now, as we just said, we also need the Wronskian condition to hold. We need that the canonical commutation relations hold. And the beauty of having decoupled the harmonic oscillators is that if we now plug that ansatz into the equation for the canonical commutation relations of the chi, then we obtain that as long as the mode functions vk obey this condition, where there's no Dirac delta here, it's just for each individual harmonic oscillator, its own commutation relations. As long as these mode functions obey that equation, that Wronskian condition, we are fine. After all, we're just solving each harmonic oscillator individually. So I leave it to you to prove that the fulfillment of the canonical commutation relations translates into this Wronskian condition. Also, another exercise that you may want to do is this. You can try to show, and that's a fun non-trivial exercise, you try to show that if the VK is such that the Wronskian condition is obeyed at one point in time, that then it is automatically also obeyed at all points in time. We know it has to be like this because the time evolution is generated by a Hermitian operator, therefore the time evolution is unitary. And we showed in complete generality in some previous lecture that whenever you apply unitaries to any commutation relation, it's going to be preserved.
So before we had real value mode functions, now they're complex?
Yes, that's right. But it's only, they're always complex.
Oh, they're wrong.
Always complex because remember that on the right hand side, we always have like I, H bar, Dirac delta, or I, H bar, something, right? So it's always complex.
And this one, now we can have just one because no sum implied.
Yes. Yes. We just need one solution. Of course, overall, we still need infinitely many because for every K, we need to do this. It's just that. We have now decomposed this problem of finding infinitely many mode functions into finding infinitely many mode functions that each individually just have to obey one condition instead of all of them together to conspire to give you a Dirac delta. Oh. Okay, so the conclusion so far is this. In order to obtain the solution to our quantum field theory, we need to find for every co-moving mode k, a solution, a mode function vk of eta, that is to say a solution to the classical harmonic oscillator with time-dependent frequency that we wrote down, the Klein-Gödel equation, and once we have that, we have to make sure that this solution also obeys the Wronskian condition. Which is not hard, because imagine that we have found a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, and now we plug it in here, and we find it's not 2i, but instead it's 7i. Well, then we can just divide the function that we found by a suitable factor such that it is 2i. It's just a normalization now. It's not a difficult condition to obey, except can't choose a real valued solution. Because if you choose a real valued solution, then this is the same as that, and you get that the right hand side is zero, and then you can't renormalize it. So this is what forces you that. It's a complex valued solution, but you can choose any complex valued solution and then renormalize it so that this condition is obeyed. So the Wronskian condition comes out to be easy to fulfill. Right, so once we've done that, once we've picked a solution for every one of these mode oscillators and normalized it to obey the Wronskian condition, then we are done. Then we can use those AK and AK dagger that came with the mode functions and build a fork basis. We can, you know, start with a vector zero and then apply the eight daggers to create other basis vectors. And in this way, we obtain a Hilbert space with a concrete basis, and we obtain the field and its canonically conjugate field, the chi and the pi superscript chi, in terms of explicit operators A and A dagger that explicitly act on the basis vectors of this Hilbert space, so everything is completely defined. We can, for example, calculate the expectation value of chi, we can calculate the expectation value of chi squared, and once we have the two of them, we can calculate the variance of k, of chi for any k, and so on. And of course, we shouldn't do it for the chi only, we should do it for phi, which is easy to do because phi differs from chi only by scale factor A. All right, so we can calculate all of those things. But there was this choice of mode function. It's easy now to choose a mode function, but not unique. You see, we could choose mode functions Vk, which are some solution, some complex valued solutions properly normalized to the Klein-Gödel equation, or another bunch of mode functions for each harmonic oscillator, Vk tilde. We can use both of them to describe the same quantum field phi hat of x and t. But, you know, if we represent the phi hat in terms of the V and the A, then we are building a different basis in the Hilbert space than if we write down our field phi hat in terms of the V tilde and the A tilde and AK dagger tilde. So we get this basis and that basis from these two choices here. In principle, none of them is better than any other. They are both just basis to two bases to the same Hilbert space, and we can use any one we want. And of course, there are infinitely many of these choices to be made. But there is the factor of convenience. We will often find it convenient to use the basis 0 and a dagger, k, 0, and so on, this basis that comes with a set of mode functions v, at one time, and I think I mentioned that earlier today already, for example, at an earlier time where space-time is behaving pretty much like Minkowski space, where we know which mode functions we should choose, and then space-time does something, and then maybe it turns into Minkowski space again. That's just a simple picture. Of course, it will be more complicated later on. But in that case, you would later then choose mode functions again. And it turns out that even if you have that, if you have Minkowski space, then the universe expands and then Minkowski space again. It doesn't mean that the two mode functions are the same, right? Even though it's mode functions early, mode functions late, they don't have to be the same. Because remember, they need to be solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation for all time, right? So those functions that solve the Klein-Gödel equation at early time in the Minkowski way, they undergo some non-trivial evolution during the expansion phase of the universe. And then when you look at those mode functions later, after the universe is done expanding, you find that, no, they are not having the usual behavior of Minkowski space mode functions. Instead, it's going to be different ones that we may call Vk tilde. And then we can ask, well, okay, how are these guys related to those? And we get Bogoliubov transformations and particle creation. So let's do this. Right, so let's remember how this stuff can happen. We are working here in the Heisenberg picture, which means that the state, it's always the same. We prepare a system in an initial state, and then that's the same Hilbert space vector always. But in the Heisenberg picture, the observables evolve in time. And it's the observables that give the states their meaning. Right? So if the observables change over time, then the same Hilbert space vector can mean different things. I mean, the simplest situation is this. Imagine at an early time, you look at the Hamiltonian and you look at its lowest energy state and pick that state. Let's call it omega, state omega. And then stuff happens. The Hamiltonian is time dependent. And at the later time, we're looking at this time dependent Hamiltonian and look at its ground state. And then we will find it's a different state. It might be called, I don't know, omega tilde, different Hilbert space vector, right? So what we find is that the same vector that used to be the lowest energy state is maybe no longer the lowest energy state later on. That's what I meant when I said that it's the operators that give Hilbert space vectors their meaning. So remember that in, you know, Schrödinger picture, the operators are frozen and the state is evolving, but here the state is frozen and the operators are evolving. So let's keep all of that in mind. So the observables evolve in time. So therefore, the meanings of all Hilbert space vectors change over time. What used to be an eigenvector to some operator may no longer be an eigenvector or whatever other properties there might be. Okay, so for example, we may choose a set of mode functions Vk, a set of solutions, therefore, to the Klein-Gödel equation that obey the Wronskian condition. We may choose a set Vk whose corresponding vector 0, the one that's annihilated by the corresponding A and Eigen operators, happens to be the vacuum state at one time. And then, at a later time, we may choose another set of mode functions such that their corresponding vector 0 tilde is the one that happens to be the vacuum state at another time. That would be super useful because if we then calculate the Bogoliubov transformation between the two, we obtain the rate of the amount of particle production. Namely, by calculating what the initial vacuum state is interpreted in the later basis. And the basis where another state is not a vacuum state later on. Okay, so for this, let us have a bit of an overview. How many possible choices are there for these mode functions? Clearly, we can choose one set of mode functions, another set, yet another set, in fact, infinitely many. But can we parameterize it? How many parameters are there? How many dimensions does the space of mode functions have per each mode? So let us consider a particular mode. We just pick one out, K, and look at this one in particular. Then let us ask, how many candidates are there for mode functions? In other words, how many solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation do they exist? So what's the dimension of the space of solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation? Does anybody know? Klein-Gödel equation, second time derivative. What's the dimension of the space of solutions? How many initial conditions do you have to give? Two, that's right. Like, because it's second derivative, right? So what you get is a two-dimensional solution space to the Klein-Gödel equation, but two complex dimensional, because you know, each solution can be multiplied with any complex number, it's still a solution. So what we obtain is a two complex dimensional solution space to the Klein-Gödel equation, which is four real dimensions. And if Vk is a complex valued solution, and we need always them to be complex valued because of the Wronskian condition, then it's canonically, then its complex conjugate is also a solution simply because the coefficient here is real. So if V is a solution and V star is a solution too. It's also a solution, and it turns out that if V is complex, is a complex valued solution, you can easily show that Vk and Vk star together form a basis of that two-dimensional space. Just because this is then not going to be proportional to that. And since there are only two dimensions, these two guys form a basis. not in any way orthogonal, they don't have to be orthogonal or anything, but they do form a basis to the solution space. So this means that every mode function that we might consider is a linear combination of mode functions V and V star, right? So if we pick a solution, if we pick a complex valued solution for our harmonic oscillator, for our mode, then this solution V and its complex conjugate together form a basis in the space of all solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation for that harmonic oscillator. And therefore, any other choice of solution has to be a linear combination of these two. So once you have a solution V and its complex conjugate, then you're guaranteed that every other solution that you may possibly want to pick, let's call it V tilde, has to be a linear combination of these two. So there's got to exist coefficients alpha and beta such that this equation holds, simply on the grounds that the Klein-Gordon equation only contains second derivatives in time. Therefore, two initial conditions suffice, etc., solution space, two-dimensional. So one might think that the solution space is too complex or four real-dimensional, but it's not quite, because I mean, it's true that the solution space has four dimensions and four real dimensions and two complex dimensions, but we can't use all of them because the Wronskian condition also needs to be obeyed. That's a normalization condition. So therefore, the actual dimensionality is one dimension less, one real dimension less. That's because whatever solution we pick, whatever mode function we pick, it also has to obey this equation, the Wronskian condition. And since this is the complex conjugate of that, this is simply saying, this equation is simply saying that the imaginary part of V prime V star is one, which is one real equation here. All right, so our space of mode functions, of candidates for mode functions, is three-dimensional. It's not a three-dimensional vector space, a three-dimensional manifold. The set of solutions is four-dimensional, is a four-dimensional vector space. But this condition is a nonlinear condition, right? It's a nonlinear condition because it has V, V in here, right? So therefore, the set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that obey that equation doesn't form a vector space. If you take two of them and add them, the sum of them doesn't obey this anymore. So it's a manifold, it's a three-dimensional manifold. Okay, so when we choose our mode functions, then we have to make a choice for every k, for every momentum k. We have to make a choice of which solution to choose out of a three-dimensional set of candidates. Now, because of the Wronskian condition, as I said, you can't just take any linear combination of the V and the V star and expect to get another candidate for a mode function. Any linear combination of V and V star is going to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, but not necessarily also of the Wronskian condition. Now, you can calculate what condition the alpha and beta coefficients have to take such that the V tilde together with V tilde star obey the Wronskian condition. So that this is also a candidate for a mode function. So if the V and V star are a mode function, so they obey the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition, we want the V tilde and the V tilde star also to do this. And that means that these coefficients have to obey that equation here. We had a special case, we had a more general case of that earlier when we considered quantization on any space-time, and we had the non-uniqueness there. Okay, I will leave it to you as an exercise to prove that this is the case. Simply plug this V tilde in terms of the right-hand side into the Wronskian condition and see what conditions alpha and beta have to obey, assuming that V and V star obey the Wronskian condition, and this is the thing you get. All right. So what we obtain here is that we can write the chi field, which solves our quantum field theory. We can write it in terms of linear combinations of untilded V's and A's, or tilded V's, V tildes and A tildes, or V with double tilde and A with double tilde, etc. Infinitely many ways to do it. We can pick those mode functions out of a three-dimensional set of candidates for every k. Right, then remember the terminology. The transformation of the basis in the Hilbert space from the basis that comes with the untilded ones to the basis that comes with the tilded mode functions and operators is a Bogoliubov transformation. Sometimes the word is used for the basis change of the vectors, and sometimes it's used to express how the operators go into each other, but always the same thing, you're just choosing different bases. So now we have two tasks. First is to make the Bogoliubov-Hilbert space transformations explicit. So far we just said it ought to exist, but let's calculate it. And remember what we get at the end of that. If we go through the trouble of doing all of this, we can calculate how the expansion of the universe creates particles out of nothing in pairs. So we want to calculate the Bogoliubov-Hilbert space transformation. And we also have to find out what is a good choice for these mode functions. We now know that we have a three-dimensional set of candidates for mode functions that we can use. A three-dimensional set of functions vk, or v tilde k, or double tilde k, etc., which obey the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition. Which one should we choose for convenience? Remember, we can choose any one we want, but some are more convenient than others. Okay, so we need to do the Bogoliubov transformations and then find out which mode function choices are convenient. Okay, so Bogoliubov transformation. The key question is this. Assume we have the basis vectors, the tilted basis vectors, obtained by taking the zero tilde vector and then applying the A tilde dagger operators on it. And we know that alternatively we could choose this Hilbert basis, but by Stone and von Neumann, at least in the ultraviolet, infrared, regularized case, these guys are a basis of the same Hilbert space as those. And therefore, each of these vectors is a linear combination of those vectors, and vice versa. Now, Bogoliubov transformation, as I said, can be viewed as involving, or does involve, change of basis. So these basis vectors can be expressed in terms of those basis vectors and vice versa. But underlying that is, of course, that the A operators are linear combinations of the A tilde operator. If you remember, we already saw that at the very beginning of the course when we studied just the driven harmonic oscillator. There we already had this in and out operators, in and out A and A dagger operators. And here too, we will have that basically the untilded ones might be the in A operators and the tilded ones might be the out operators. We're just more flexible here, so we don't call them A in, A out just yet. All right. So now, here's the proposition that we will prove, namely that the AK operator is a linear combination of the tildes operator, the tilded operators. Where do these alpha and beta come from? Remember, the alpha and beta were the linear combination coefficients that express the mode functions in terms of each other. If the tilded mode functions expressed in terms of the untilded mode functions and vice versa. Actually, I'm not proving it here. I'm leaving it to you as an exercise to prove that. But, you know, just substitute stuff in there. But these calculations are at the heart of quantum field theory on curved space-time, so you may want to do them at least once. And then if you do actual work in cosmology, you will do it all the time. Okay. So now we observe that given this relationship between the A and the tilde A, we have that the defining condition on the vector zero, namely that it is annihilated by all of the AK operators, that defining condition can now be written as this operator, which is the AK, acting on that vector zero being equal to zero. This is a key equation because it relates the tilded quantities to an untilded quantity, and therefore will provide the link that we need in order to relate this basis to that basis. All right, so keep that in mind because I have to flip the page now. So we have that A tildes and A tilde daggers acting on that vector zero is equal to zero. That's a non-trivial equation to solve. And here's an ansatz for it. Let me just go back up again. Okay. So here's the equation that we have to solve. These operators acting on that is equal to zero. Now, we don't know how these tilded operators act on that just yet. But we do know that this thing must be some linear combination of these basis vectors of the tilded one. So what we'll now do is make a clever ansatz, make a clever guess for how that thing could look like in that basis. Here's the ansatz. Namely, we are saying, the vector zero ought to be expressible in terms of the vector zero tilde, but momentum by momentum separately. Because every harmonic oscillator is independent from every other harmonic oscillator. We should be able to express this vector in terms of that vector in a way that involves the different modes independently. So it's a function of the A tildes acting on the zero tildes, and then it's just a product of them, which means that, you know, whatever you do for one mode, you do for the others as well. Now that answer succeeds. And what you find is that the vector zero is obtained by acting with this operator on that vector zero tilde. Let's analyze what we have here. And never mind about this thing, that's just a normalization factor that's needed to make sure that this vector is normalized. What we have here is the product of exponentials. And for every k, we get a separate product there. But we might as well just look at one momentum separately, because the same thing plays out for all co-moving momenta. What we see here is that the vector zero is obtained by applying the exponential of this product of two creation operators, a dagger, onto that zero tilde vector. For example, if this is the vector that describes the no particle state early, before the universe expands, and if this is the vector that describes the no particle state after all of the expansion is done, or at least after all of the wild expansion is done, then we see here what this early vacuum state, which is still the state of the field after all, because it's the isotropic picture, it's frozen, what this early vacuum state is from the perspective of an observer who lives at a late time in which this is the vacuum state. this late observer will say, oh, the state that the field is in is not the vacuum at all, because it's a state that is full of particles. You see, all of this is acting on the zero tilde vector. Plenty of particle production here. Well, plenty is not so, not guaranteed, because the beta may be really small. Right? If beta is zero, then we just have e to the power zero, and then we have that the two states are the same. Which, by the way, is a very important observation that serves you well whenever you do anything with quantum cosmology and quantum field theory in cosmology. When in a Ogolyubov transformation, the beta coefficients are zero, you're not getting particle creation. Okay? You can have Ogolyubov transformations with only alpha coefficients. For example, if you rotate a coordinate system, you get alpha coefficients, but not beta coefficients. If you rotate them and keep rotating them, so you go from an inertial coordinate system to one that keeps rotating, then you get beta coefficients. But not if you just take it from here and then place it there. No. And the beta coefficients, remember where, how they come up? When you express, I'll just show you the equations. It's easier. Right. This is what it is. The A operator is alpha coefficient times A plus beta coefficients times A dagger. You see, if beta is zero, you're only expressing the alphas in terms of the alphas. But if beta is non-zero, you get creation operators mixing with annihilation operators. That is what makes particle creation happen. Okay, so leave it to you as an exercise to plug that solution into that equation that we had to solve. Remember what equation we had to solve? It was this one, right? So you express the vector zero in terms of all of this product of exponentials of a tilde dagger applied to the a tilde vacuum, right? A tilde state, and then apply that to this. This got to be zero. This is what we need to get. And remember that that expression here contains blah, 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 and then a tilde dagger acting on zero tilde. Now this is an a tilde without a dagger, and that's an a tilde with a dagger, right? So you have to apply these things onto that big expression over there and then see that the equation holds. It's a bit of algebra, but you can do it. Okay, so you just plug that, so you substitute this, all of this expression here for the vector zero, and then check that the equation holds. Right. So depending on what the Bogolyubov transformation is, we get more or less particle production here. And as I promised at the beginning of the lecture today, what we see here is that the particles are being created in pairs. Because whenever you have an A dagger acting on this minus K, you get also an A dagger with K. So the expansion of the universe will create particles in pairs with opposite momentum. And for all momenta, right? And not just pairs, but also multiples of pairs. Because this exponential starts out with 1 plus this squared, plus this to the sixth power, plus this to the millionth power, etc. So you get that not only one particle in this direction, in that direction, but, you know, multiple, and always in opposed, always going as much to the right as going to the left. By the way, particle creation through the expansion of the universe is not something completely new. Even in ordinary quantum field theory, such as quantum electrodynamics, you can have an analogous effect. You can have that, for example, an electric field, a static electric field, can be made so strong that the vacuum fluctuations of electron-positron pairs get ripped apart. And the electron goes to one electrode and the positron goes to the negative electrode. And so you get particle creation out of just an electric field. Here you get it out of expansion, of curvature, of space-time curvature. Now the effect hasn't been observed yet for electromagnetism, but experimentalists are working on that. It's called the Schwinger effect, when a very strong electric field creates positrons and electrons. Right, and there's a hint, if you want to substitute that into that equation that we need to show is fulfilled by this ansatz, then you may find it useful to know that this equation holds. Namely that the commutator between A and e to the power lambda A dagger is lambda e to the power lambda A dagger. Maybe you remember from an earlier lecture that the commutator between A and any function of A dagger is the derivative of that function of A dagger. And that's just what we see here too, right? If you put this on the left-hand side, you see it's the commutator between A and a function of A dagger, and that's the derivative. And the reason is, of course, that while we have A dagger minus A dagger A equal to 1, we also have that dxx minus x dx equal to 1. Right? Same thing. That's why that works. If you want to prove this, just put any function f of x here, same function f of x here, f of x here, and then keep in mind that the d by dx acts not only on the x, but also on the function. And you get two terms, one of which eats up this, and the other one just gives you the function again. All right, so here we have the Bogoliubov transformation T, and what I'm writing here. The end is that interpretation of this is, of course, that if, for example, we choose our mode functions V and V tilde in such a way that the corresponding vector 0 and the vector 0 tilde correspond to the vacuum state at early times and the vacuum state at late times, then this describes particle creation. Of course, I haven't told you yet how we can choose the mode functions such that the vector 0 describes the vacuum state at early time or the vacuum state at late time. And I didn't tell you with a good reason, because it's quite non-trivial. We cannot simply say, oh, we just have to choose the mode function such that the A operator annihilates the ground state. Because that would mean that the vacuum stays the ground state. But as we will see a little later, that's not so. The vacuum state is not the ground state. In fact, if we assume that the vacuum state is the ground state, and we do exactly this calculation, and then plug in the alpha and beta coefficients that we get for the current observed, the best known scale factor as a function of time, then we can calculate from exactly this expression how much particle creation the universe does. And it's more than is experimentally observed. Right? So there's experimental evidence that says these two states cannot just be the energy ground states. Because if we simply choose them to be the energy ground states, this calculation predicts too much particle production because of the expansion of the universe. And not just at the early universe, no, over the past billions of light years, just the past 10 billions of light years, while the universe was coasting relatively smoothly, you would have too much particle creation. So therefore, we will need to find a more sophisticated definition of what is the vacuum state, what is a no particle state. It's not the lowest energy state. It's almost that, but not quite. And why that is a non-trivial question, I can explain in this way. Imagine you have a harmonic oscillator whose parameters you're changing over time. For example, you might have a pendulum, a harmonic oscillator. And imagine you pull or let loose the string. So you make the pendulum longer or shorter, which means that you're changing its resonance frequency, right? Now, you might think that it's easy to calculate the resonance frequency, because the resonance frequency is normally just given by the length of the pendulum, right? The length of, once you know the length of the pendulum, you can easily calculate what the resonance frequency is. But imagine that you're changing the length of the pendulum in some non-trivial way. So you're letting go, pulling, letting go, pulling, letting go in some weird way. Well then, what is the resonance frequency of the pendulum at any point in time, right? It can't resonate at whatever frequency you apply because the length changes all the time. So what you see is that the very notion of a resonance frequency is non-trivial. The very notion of a resonance frequency is non-trivial when the harmonic oscillator has time-dependent coefficient. We can't simply take the parameters at a snapshot in time and say, at the moment, the resonance frequency is this. What does it mean operationally? There's no operation you can do to check that this is the resonance frequency, because by the time you try to build up resonance, the harmonic oscillator has changed frequency already, right? And so similarly here, for harmonic oscillators whose parameters are changing over time, the momentary ground state is as little informative as is the momentary resonance frequency of a harmonic oscillator with varying coefficients. All right, so we will do this next. And I think, right, okay, no, that's just in so many sentences written down what I just already said to you in words. Okay, any questions? Yes?
That operator that converts between the two vacuum states?
Yes.
It reminds me of like a displacement operator or something that generates the coherent states.
Yeah.
Like
yes, it's a two-mode squeeze state operator.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yes. And in quantum optics, you can actually generate similar things as well. Pretty nice that in quantum optics you can mimic a lot of what's going on in cosmology. Right. Okay. So next, we will need to find out how to define the no particle state. We will see that in generic curved spacetimes, other than FRW, we should not expect that there even exists such a thing, a no particle state. But in FRW spacetimes, it does, and we have a good guess for which state it is. We'll find out what that is. And then we will get more and more realistic. We will apply that to realistic spacetimes, and eventually we will take into account that what the field does, what the Klein-Gordon field does, is also impacting what the space-time does. So if the Klein-Gordon field has energy momentum fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor, that should imprint itself onto the space-time. So we will calculate how the FRW space-time is modified by the energetic fluctuations of the Klein-Gordon field. So it won't be completely flat. No, the space-time is flat, except quantum fluctuations of the Klein-Gordon field will imprint themselves onto the space-time. And then those fluctuations are thought to have seeded the condensation later of hydrogen into stars and galaxies, and therefore the entire structure formation. All right. I notice I keep anticipating a lot of things. Okay. All right, any more questions? Yes.
We talked about the wavelengths that are frozen. Can we detect those?
Yes, that's the point. The frozen ones are the ones that seeded the structure in the universe. Yeah. Oh. But at the moment, they're no longer frozen. You see, when the universe was expanding super fast at the very beginning, the horizon was very small because the acceleration of the universe was so dramatic. Observers that were just like 10 to the minus 29 meters apart from each other could no longer communicate with each other. And wavelengths, waves of wavelengths larger than 10 to the minus 29 meters, which is really tiny, were frozen. And not just them, that would be a classical phenomenon. their quantum fluctuations were, right? And then they were stretched while inflation was going on, while the exponential quasi-exponential expansion was going on. Those fluctuations were stretched to cosmological size, but then inflation ended. The dramatic acceleration ended, but the fluctuations were there, right? They were there and they were big, and then it ended. And so then the horizon was no longer 10 to the minus 29 meters, then the horizon became huge. Now the horizon is in the dozens of billions of light years. So if there were waves now, like electromagnetic waves or whatever kind of waves, that have a wavelength of like 200 billion light years, they wouldn't oscillate. Just because of a classical phenomenon already, just the Klein-Gordon equation or the Maxwell equations, they don't oscillate. But the horizon is now so far away. I mean, we have an acceleration apparently in the universe now, but the cosmological constant is not very large. So the acceleration is relatively small and the horizon is pretty far away. You can't see it. Well, you can never see beyond the horizon. Yeah. But so in principle, yes, the phenomenon is still going on, but it doesn't impact the evolution of our part of the universe. But early on, shortly after Big Bang, it did. Any more questions? Okay, great. See you on Friday.